Upfront, inside the entertainment industry, is brought to you by member-supported Jazz 91.9 WCLK.
Coming up on this week's edition of Upfront, Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall are here to chat about their highly anticipated sequel, Coming to America, which debuts on Amazon Prime this weekend. ABC Chief Justice Correspondent Pierre Thomas is here to chat about their new series, Soul of a Nation, which debuted earlier this week. And closing out the show is my birthday salute to music icon and founding member of the Supremes, Mary Wilson. I'll be talking to media personality Patrick Riley about her life, legacy, and much more. I'll also be playing Supremes classics all throughout the show, but first, here's a message from the High Museum of Art.
Support for WCOK programming comes from the High Museum of Art, presenting an exhibition of the life and legacy of Georgia native David Driscoll now through May 9th, 2021. The exhibition showcases Driscoll's painting and printmaking practices and 60 works of art spanning 7 decades of his career as an artist, curator, and scholar. Time tickets are required. More information is available at high.org.
My world is empty without you, babe. My world is empty without you, babe. From this old world, I try to hide my face. But from this loneliness, there's no hiding place. Inside this cold and empty house, I dwell. In darkness with memories I know so well.
This is Lisa Arendelle, and you're listening to Ray Cornelius on Upfront.
My first segment features the legendary stars of Coming to America, Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall. The highly anticipated Amazon Prime film reunites them in their iconic roles, as well as a number of other familiar faces and some new ones, in an all-new adventure that Eddie claims was 32 years in the making.
Coming to America kind of became like it's kind of like a cult movie. Like the people that like it really, really like it. And they've watched it for years and years, and they watch it on TV. It's one of those movies when you're flipping through the channels on the TV, if you see it's on, you kind of stop and look at it for a minute. It's one of those movies. And it worked its way into the culture where you have, like, on Halloween, people get dressed up as characters. I've seen, like, people in Halloween costumes and Zamunda themed parties, and on Christmas they show it 24 hours straight on VH1. So it kind of worked its way into the culture. That's kind of how the movie kind of got started. It was like, we didn't even think about doing a sequel to this picture. We were like, we had kind of left it behind. And then because it's kind of stayed in the air for so long, and because it had this kind of cult following, it was like, you know, the people that really, really, really like Coming to America, I think they would kind of like to see another Coming to America. And that was about 6 years ago when that idea came together.
Guys, this movie is hilarious. And I totally loved seeing all of the iconic characters coming back from the guys from the Mighty Shop, as well as Reverend Brown, who's my favorite character, Arsenio. What was it like revisiting those iconic characters? Because I just started laughing just looking at you.
You know, part of the magic is brought by Ruth E. Carter. Once she does what she does, all you got to do is look in the mirror, and the makeup guys are geniuses. It comes back immediately. I hate to use cliches, but it's like riding a bike. Once Ruth does your body and those brothers do your face, you're in. You're immediately in. It hits a button.
Yeah, you have all that stuff on. It's like, well, I got to do something now. You got hold on for 6 hours. I can't just walk out there and be
And one thing to Ray, there's a scene where the preacher was so lecherous, Amazon made us take it out. He's a horrible man. I'll put it like this. He was doing crazy stuff in the baptismal pool when Eddie and Tracy and everybody walked in. This horrible man.
Eddie and Arsenio also talked about how his films like Coming to America and Harlem Nights were often used as a bridge between the older and newer generations of comedic talent.
Well, it's a good feeling to inspire the generation that comes behind you. And I've always tried to connect the stuff with movies that I've always tried to connect with the behind me and in front of me, when I do movies, and I'll get like comedians or people that I've admired or people I want to work with. And I love having the fresh new ones around, and I love being on the set and seeing, you know, John Amos. You know, when I was a kid, you know, John Amos, and to this day, John Amos is the only time I've seen the black father on television. It was like, that's who, that guy reminds me of my father. It was the only time I've ever seen it. All the other shows is like, John Amos on Good Times is the only time I've seen the black father. So be on a set with somebody like him, to be in a movie with James Earl Jones, or to work with Richard Pryor and Red Fox. I always tried to get the people from that was behind me and the new people on the come up. I always want to connect myself to that chain. I've always tried to do it. So I love it when, you know, I'm around young comics, you know, young actors that's, oh yeah, I was inspired by what you did. And to be around that energy, I love being around it.
And by the way, you know what's really cool? I think Eddie brought this up yesterday. James Earl Jones and Morgan Freeman have never been in a movie together. And that surprised me. That's incredible to be there.
Yep, and now they're in this movie.
Watch the rest of the AFCA Roundtable discussion with the stars of Coming to America, Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall, at WCLK.com.
Support for WCLK programming comes from the Life Lux Jazz Experience, November 4th through the 8th, 2021, in Los Cabos, Mexico. Performers include Eric Roberson, Mesa, Mike Phillips, Hiroshima, and is hosted by Mark Curry. There will also be health and wellness activities and a sunset cruise. Information is available at LifeLuxJazz.com.
Through the mirror of my mind, time after time, I see reflections of you and me, reflections of the way life used to be, reflections of the love you took from me.
Cassie Davis here. You're listening to Upfront with Ray Cornelius. Take it away, Ray!
My next segment features Chief Justice Correspondent for ABC News, Pierre Thomas. The veteran journalist is here to discuss the network's new six-part news magazine series titled Soul of a Nation. The one-hour program focuses on the Black experience in America and features commentary on reconciliation, spirituality, Black joy, activism in sports, and the racial reckoning that erupted after the death of George Floyd last year. The special debuted this past Tuesday night, and Thomas opened with an interview featuring an African-American officer who recalls the racist attacks he endured at the Capitol on January the 6th. Here's how the story came about.
Well, as the news always unfolds, it was organic. You know, we had the insurrection. We knew that there were some stories there, especially with the Confederate flag and the people making anti-Semitic remarks and the different things we saw. We knew there was a story there. Then we get word that there's a African-American police officer with the Capitol Police who initially told his story anonymously. And then it was mentioned during the Senate trial that there was an African-American police officer who was called the N-word 15 times during the insurrection. So we went on a mission to see if we could find this officer and see if he would be willing to tell his story on the record. And thankfully he was. And sometimes when you get an interview, you're hoping that you find truth. And one of the truths that we found is that race wasn't just a theme during the insurrection. It was a dominant theme inside that building. And to hear that man tell his story of fighting for his country, fighting to protect members of Congress. And as I said in the interview, race seeped into that too. And he describes this moment where, you know, he's tired and he confronts a group of about 30 people. And he starts to engage with them because he's trying to buy some time to rest and also hoping as a good officer that maybe he can talk these people through and not have to resort to violence to deal with them. And they start telling him, well, nobody voted for Biden. You know, the election was stolen. You know, it can't be true that he won. And he said, quote, I took the bait. And he said, I voted for Biden. Does my vote not count? And there's a couple. And then one of the members of the couple said, this blank N-word voted for Joe Biden. Then the other member of the couple said, this blank voted for Joe Biden. And the next thing he knows, he's the victim, the target of 30 to 40 people chanting, this N voted for Joe Biden. And the moment where, you know, he ends up in the Capitol Rotunda, and I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's such a beautiful building and the ceiling goes up, it seems like forever. And there's all these wonderful murals. It's just grand is the word you would use. And he looks around in that moment later in the day, and there's trash throughout the rotunda. There's water bottles. There's, you know, smoke in the air from the tear gas and the munitions that the mob was using. And he sits beside a friend of his, and tears start flowing down his cheeks. And he said, I got called the N-word more than a dozen times a day. Is this America? And you're interviewing him, and kind of a gulp comes up in your throat because he's taking you there. And Harry Dunn is his name, ends up being a natural, wonderful storyteller. And I don't know whether he's had training, but I have to tell you, he broke down the moment and how he felt in such a real and sincere way. And I've been struck by the response to the interview, family and friends, and just, you know, but it's a part of what Soul of the Nation wants to do, real conversation. In this case, two Black men. And Cornelius, I have to tell you, I couldn't sit down with him and help but share some of myself with him, you know, as we had this conversation, because I wanted him to know that, yeah, I'm a journalist, but I'm in this conversation with you. And I think if there's any theme about Soul of the Nation, I think we want to take America inside some of the Black experience. Now, you can't, it's such a myriad, complex, layered, we're not going to be able to do it all. But I think that conversation is one worth having and one worth, you know, delving into.
You mentioned that you were able to really share part of yourself as you were doing the interview. And as a viewer, we were able to see that. And I said, you know what, for the first time, I'm really getting to see and learn a little bit more about who you are as a person. I feel like this series is allowing you guys to kind of let your hair down. You know, I love some of the editing of the show. It was, there were some moments that were very comical and I was like, now that's real Black. I was like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, like the in the kitchen with Sunny. I mean, she's as real as it gets. Wonderful colleague. Byron Pitts's piece about reparations was, I thought, really informative in his elegant stories telling style. And, you know, Adrian Banker, you're going to hear from Lindsay Davis, TJ Holmes, so many of my colleagues getting a chance to play a role and contribute to this, what we believe is a landmark series.
Catch the full conversation with ABC News' Pierre Thomas at WCLK.com.
I've had my share and I drank my fill. And even though I'm satisfied, I'm hungry still to see what's down another road beyond the hill and do it all again.
This is Coleman Domingo, and you're listening to Upfront with Ray Cornelius.
You just heard the voice of music legend and founding member of the Supremes, Mary Wilson, performing the jazz standard, Here's to Life. I was scheduled to chat with the iconic Motown performer last month as part of my Black History Month salute, but had to reschedule our interview at the last minute. Unfortunately, Miss Wilson died before we were able to record the interview. So in celebration of what would have been her 77th birthday today, I'm talking to producer, media personality, and pop culture expert, Patrick Riley, about Miss Wilson's life and her supreme legacy.
This was a loss for the culture. Thank you, Ray, for having me on to lift the name of Mary Wilson. You know, when you first had me on Upfront, I was there to promote my book, That's What Friends Are For, on the women who inspired me. And this book's what? It's been out 2 years. And we've lost so many of our greats since this book came out. I mean, before the book even came out, Aretha Franklin is gone. Diane Carroll, Della Reese, Lena Horne, many people who I wanted to make sure we amplified and didn't forget in the grand scheme of history and the culture, and making sure that we don't get lost in the sauce of that greatness that we come from. We're losing them. And I don't know that we anticipated that we would lose Mary Wilson this soon. I mean, when we think about next or who might be next, you know, you can't guess it, you can't predict it, but I don't think any of us thought Mary Wilson would be gone this soon. You mentioned preparing for Black History Month 2021. Mary Wilson, no day before she passed away, was preparing for a big Black History Month 2021. Is it related to the legacy of the Supremes? If you saw her final video on YouTube, she spoke of how amazing things have happened to the Supremes in February. Stopping the Name of Love went number one in February. Also, sad things happened in February. We lost Florence Ballard in 1976, February 26. So the idea that she, one day before she passed away, was thinking kind of the good, the bad, and the ugly of what February represents for the Supremes, and then she was gone, is truly, truly sad. But I had an opportunity many, many years ago via Good Day Atlanta to meet Mary Wilson in Atlanta, promoting whatever the show du jour was. And she, from as early on as the early 90s, was the what I call the approachable Supreme. She was the networking Supreme, who was the keeper of the flame, the keeper of all roster changes of the Supremes. Because everyone knows Miss Ross was definitely the leader for that decade in the 60s where they had all the great hits. But Mary Wilson is the one who kept it going. When Jean Terrell came into the mix after Miss Ross left in 70, Mary Wilson, though not the singing leader, was truly the leader, the contractor of all the appearances, the gowns, the looks, the visions. And she continued to make sure she hired girls to fit that archetype of three girls who represented really the example of what a pop girl group is. And that is what the Supremes were. They were the example, the exemplar of what a successful, well choreographed, well trained group of women who have extensive talent, who are preparing their talent for kings and queens, as their as Maxine Powell once said. That's the woman who gave them all the charms via the artist development component of Motown that just sort of crunk out superstars like the assembly line at Ford Motor Company, you know, and Mary Wilson, Diana Ross, and Florence Ballard, I think represent that magic that Motown will forever represent. And it's interesting that even though she wasn't the lead singer in the Supremes, Mary Wilson truly was the holder of the flame. And I think even if you were to speak to Miss Ross today, she would agree. She always sort of kept the legacy of the Supremes in the hands of Mary Wilson.
When I think of Mary Wilson, I think of that amazing smile. She had such a twinkle in her eye. And you're right, she was really the approachable Supreme that I think, you know, when people think of that group and the magic, it really was all three of these women coming together as a collective with that one voice, with that one sound. And it changed. Yes. The way that I think our country looked at African-American women, especially at that time, they had never seen glamorous Black women on television. We were never given the opportunity to be glamorous and beautiful on television. And so when the Supremes came out at that time, it just, you know, you listen to stories from Oprah Winfrey and so many others that were inspired by these three brown girls from Detroit, and the rest is history. Let's talk, if you will, Patrick, about your opportunity of being there the night that Motown the Musical debuted. And this was an exceptional story about that whole Motown machine, you know, how Mr. Gordy was able to basically produce artists like he did when he was producing Cars, you know, working, you know, in the car industry at that time, and taking that concept and that idea and just pushing out these stars. And I always say Motown, there was something in the water in Detroit, because you have all of these stars in this one area, this one neighborhood, Aretha Franklin, and even over the years, the Clark Sisters and the Winans, and you know, so many others that have come out of Detroit. But if you can, take us back to that night at the opening for Motown the Musical.
Well, firstly, it was just an honor to be hired by Mr. Berry Gordy's marketing team for Motown the Musical to be the host of its opening night red carpet. And that meant I was interviewing all of the original Motown legends who were being chronicled on the stage, as well as many of the performers afterwards who got to portray these greats. And so it's worth noting that I did get Mr. Berry Gordy and Miss Diana Ross together, with Miss Ross telling Berry Gordy to look out for this one, meaning me, because I have a memory of steel. Miss Ross knew that I was the interviewer to really kind of hold them all accountable for that great legacy. But I also got to interview Miss Mary Wilson, who was absolutely delighted that the Supremes were going to be a part of this narrative. She was, she had confirmed at this point that she was in it, because so often in Motown's legacy, you know, it's a polarizing history where sometimes Mary Wilson and Florence could get lost in the sauce of Diana Ross's shadow, which was not always a personal thing, but it's kind of like a media driven thing or a PR driven thing. But the Supremes were very much represented in a way that made her proud. Mary, different than Diana as it related to Dreamgirls, took to the parallel that Dreamgirls represented. It was not about the Supremes, but it was about a girl group from an urban city in the 60s who went on to have great success and struggles. And so that's, on some level, would have been the extent of the parallel, but Mary took to it personally and embraced the members of that original cast of Dreamgirls 40 plus years ago to let them know that that was her story. And then she went on and adapted that into her New York Times bestseller, the memoir, Dreamgirl, My Life is a Supreme. But on this night, Mary was happy to sort of see the reunion of all Motown energies celebrating the legacy of Motown in this musical. And it would be a night, though not in a singing way, where Miss Ross and Miss Mary Wilson did come back together. At the bow on opening night, all the original stars came on stage and embraced each other as if it were a Motown 25 reunion. And it was just a beautiful moment. And then at the after party, there was a local Detroit reporter who was able to gather Berry Gordy, Mary Wilson, Diana Ross, and Jesse Jackson. You know, Jesse Jackson's always up in there. And interviewed them just on the specialness of that night, on the specialness of where they came from. There was a moment with Berry Gordy between Diana and Berry where they each kiss him and put a big red mark on his cheek. It was just a beautiful night that was sort of captured in the corner at the Roseland Ballroom, which is where the after party was. And it just showed me that as much as people want to sort of portray this feud that went on and on and on and on, it wasn't as highly charged as people knew. People really didn't realize that their energy towards each other was love. Certainly they weren't able to get back together, tour again, become best friends, best girlfriends like they were back in the day. But there was a rich, true, deep love that went all the way to when they were together the last time at the Vanity Fair Oscar party 2019. And that was just a wonderful moment where Evan Ross took his mom over to say hi to Quincy Jones and Mary Wilson. And they each all had a wonderful collective moment. I think there are some pictures out there that demonstrate that moment, but there was never any continued beef. You know, the ability to tour again, sing again is one thing, but the love they had for each other, the true special connection they had, was always there. And I had the chance just to sort of put a button on my time with Mary Wilson, October 31st, 2019, I had the chance to see Mary promote Supreme Glamour at the Newark Grammy Museum. And it was a wonderful one-on-one evening with Mary Wilson where she took Q&A. And I sought that moment to play from the place that you just referenced regarding Oprah and Whoopi and the people who lift the Supremes' names. I wanted to know if she was as aware that her LGBTQ following lifted the Supremes up in that same regard as the likes of an Oprah or a Whoopi. And I wanted to know if she and Diana and Flo were as aware of that. And she got choked up. Choked up because one, she said they were aware, but they, and they welcomed anyone who loved them. And so they early on saw that a lot of their gay followers loved them and they loved the love. But more than that, she got choked up because she said, OMG, I know that Florence would have loved to hear that sentiment. And it just moved, it moved her, it moved me, it moved the room to know that the gay icons that they are, that that's something that all these years later after Florence has left us, she would have loved. And I was happy to have touched her in that moment, this before she broke out in her wonderful rendition of Here's to Life, which is something else I want to point out is that Mary and her voice, her unique voice, that wasn't the voice that led those many, many pop classics, but her voice was something special that beyond the Supremes' run, she used to great effect as a live performer. And from her Gladys Knight rendition of I Will Survive to her Jennifer Holliday turn of I Am Changing to these beautiful jazz ballads like Here's to Life, Mary Wilson was a true entertainer and a true performer. And I don't want that to get lost in the sauce because she was reduced to oohs and ahs and baby babies. Mary Wilson is a trained, was a trained singer for our time. And I don't want that to get lost.
Catch the full conversation with Patrick Riley at WCLK.com. Well, that'll do it for this week's show. I'd like to thank all of my special guests, Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall, Pierre Thomas, and Patrick Riley. I'd also like to thank our engineer, Jami Wellman, and you. Please join us next week for another exciting edition of Upfront, Inside the Entertainment Industry.
If you like today's show, please hit us up at WCLK.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Upfront, Inside the Entertainment Industry has been brought to you by Jazz 91.9 WCLK, Atlanta's jazz station, and is recorded from the campus of Clark Atlanta University.